I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food here on KCRW and KCRW.com. Today, we're learning how to grow tomatoes. We'll take a trip to Orange County to sample some fresh tortillas and chorizo, plus a $500 six-volume book that will change the way you think about cooking. A conversation with U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, and Jonathan Gold is here with a restaurant recommendation. But first, let's head out to the Santa Monica Farmers Market to see what's fresh and in season this week in Southern California.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. A lot of us have a hard time remembering all that heavy, heavy rain we had just a few months ago. One of the farms that was hardest hit was Fairview Gardens Farm from Goleta. They literally were washed away. Everything they had planted sort of disappeared in the rain. They had very heavy rainfall. They're just now coming back to the market after a three-month absence. And we're going to be talking with Julian, who is the current farm manager, about what they managed now to bring back and finally get back to the market with.
The thing about our farm is that it's really close to the ocean, so not so much with the freezing. We had problems with rain, and we pretty much got hit with about 16 inches in a few days. So it'll, you know, on a wet farm, it'll drown your plants, and it really slows down the progress of a farm. But what's hopeful is that since we're by the coast, our Seascape variety of strawberry does really well. So it's just pumping out the biggest, sweetest strawberries right now, and that's what this variety does in the beginning of the season.
Okay, so you have the Seascapes here today?
Yes, we do.
Oh, you do, and they'll be coming on now. They're fully hydrated and ready to rock.
Exactly. Yeah. They oscillate throughout the seasons. It's red all the way through. It's got a really complex flavor.
When you get 16 inches of rain, like you did, okay, so the plants you had planted, little baby plants, they were just washed away,
yeah, they
right?
get washed away. They get drowned.
Yeah.
Some plants get root rot. Really depends on how wet your farm is in general and how it deals with the rain.
Yeah. Right. So what did you have in the ground at that time that you lost, for example?
Well, we specialize in our leafy greens, uh-huh. and we had just planted some of those, and they come in the form of starts. So once they go in the ground, they're sort of vulnerable. So if you get, you know, a lot of rain over 2 weeks, that's better than over a couple of days where, I mean, the size of the droplets will really actually break up the top of the soil and wash it away.
And what have you got in addition to the Seascapes, which just love all this water, what else have you got that really seems to be flourishing at this time?
It is spring, so we are seeing the oncoming of fava beans. Right now we just have the leaves. We've been selling them before the fava beans come because they have a great fava bean flavor, so it's just a little taster for what's to come in a few months.
Mm-hmm. Those are here now.
They're here now.
Oh. Okay, so now you guys are back. It's now mid-March, and you're back now for the rest of the season. So we're just going to be looking for a succession of great. You got some beautiful lettuces out there today.
Oh, so great!
The leafy greens are happy.
Yeah. Sort of cool weather, lots of sun, the plants mm-hmm. are loving it.
So, Julian, thanks so much, and we're so glad you're back.
Thank you, Laura.
So, strawberries, seriously, are probably one of the most consumed and beloved fruits on the planet. Roxanne Julepat is the pastry chef at Ammo, and she's at the market today, as she always is, shopping for ingredients. And can you help us out with some fantastic recipe we can use these great seasonal strawberries for?
For me, the challenge with strawberries is to exercise some restraint, because you can go a little crazy. There's a lot of options, but just because you have the options doesn't mean that you have to do them all. So the critical decision you have to make is to think what suits the strawberry the best. Right now, they are so freaking delicious that what you should do is not cook them. Recently, I challenged myself with how do you make that fresh strawberry pies that you see in all those pie shops this time of year? And they tend to be like very, very gelatinous, and the strawberries are incredibly big, and they have a lot of white in them. So I played around for like 3 days with them, and with different ratios of gelatin or different gelling agents such as cornstarch or pectin. And what worked best for me was just a minimal amount of gelatin and a tiny bit of cornstarch. So what you want to do is pick a very delicious crust, probably a little bit more sugary than other pie crusts. That is just because the pie is going to be chilled. So once you put it in the refrigerator, the crust tends to get a little st- stiffer. So you want it, when you cut your slice, you want it the shell to be a little bit more yielding, more shortbready, more crumbly. So I find that if the crust is a little sweet, has a little bit of sugar, it has that tenderness. Then when you do your strawberries, pick smaller ones rather than big ones so that your bites are a little bit more easier to bite and also like more balanced. Rather than tossing them in like strawberry gelatin out of a package, make yourself a little sauce. I like to put in mine a little bit of port, or perhaps if you don't want alcohol, you can do a little bit of blood oranges, which are like so available right now, a little bit of juice. Sweeten it just lightly because strawberries are really, really sweet right now. The trickiest part is like, when do you add the sauce to the strawberries? Because it's going to start to gel when it cools down, but you also don't want to add the sauce to the fresh strawberries that you're going to coat with this saucy mix while they're warm, because they're going to start to cook and like juice too much. And so what I do is like, I just transfer to a bowl and start searing until it comes to room temperature. Once the sauce is at room temperature, you can toss the fresh berries, toss, and pile them up into that sugary crust. Let it sit in the fridge for about an hour, and that's it.
Magic
in a pie.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm one of those people that don't care to have, like, the cleanest slice, so I don't put a lot of gelatin. But if you're, like, a person that's more presentation-oriented, you might want to up the gelatin a little bit more. To pump up the flavor of the fresh strawberries just a little bit, I do make a little bit of a homemade jam. And this time of year, and probably for the next month, a few of the citrus farmers here at the market have orange blossoms. Just get about a quarter cup from them. They sell them in a strawberry basket, and they're not that expensive. And you can make yourself a little sachet, and when you're making your homemade jam, you put that little sachet in there, and it just gives the strawberry a little bit of a different dimension. It takes it away from sweet, and it just really tastes like an orchard. It's really, really funny what happens. And it only happens this time of year, so you got a month.
Well, thanks so much, Roxanne.
Thank you so much.
That was Roxanne Julepat. She's the pastry chef at Ammo, and she and Dan Mattern, who's the executive chef, are at the Wednesday Santa Monica Market every single week shopping for seasonal produce, and we love their energy, and we love what they're cooking up every week. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
A recipe from Roxana Julepat of Ammo for fresh strawberry pie is on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. I'm joined now by Jonathan Gold. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly, and he stops by every week to whet our appetite with a restaurant recommendation.
We are going to, brace yourself, Valley Boulevard in San Gabriel. I took a friend there the other day to actually the place that I'm talking about, and she's looking incredulously and said, how do you find this place out of all the other ones? How do you know that this is the one to walk into? And I look around and it's like, you don't understand. I've actually been to all of them.
So what is this latest we're going to talk about called?
It's called Lucky Noodle King.
Does the guy have a tiara of a crown of noodles?
I'd love it if he did. I don't know what the Chinese translation is. I think it's something probably very different, but it's one of the better names. They specialize in dan dan mian, the super spicy Sichuan noodles.
So describe what dan dan mian is. Is it a cold noodle, a hot noodle? Is it in sauce?
It's a hot noodle or a hot-ish noodle in a sauce of typically, you know, minced pork, tons of chili, tons of Sichuan pepper. There's, you know, usually pickled mustard and some fried peanuts in there. Usually there's sort of a dash of bean paste in there, though some people think that the bean paste is heretical. And some people think it's the absolute soul of the dish.
So interesting.
And it's like the fast food noodle. It's the one that everybody can throw together in 5 minutes. But obviously some of them are better than others. And Chuan Yu was the best. So I'm in this restaurant. I get things that actually aren't that. And I'm looking at wall signs. And I think we got some pan-fried dumplings. I think we got some pumpkin dish fried chicken. There might have been a fried chicken. Then the dan dan mian. And the dan dan mian seems really good. And it's familiar, though. The noodles are better than they were before. The one at the place I liked had dried noodles, and these seemed very much as if they were made from fresh noodle. And at some point, I look up in the middle of, like, eating these noodles, and a woman comes out from the kitchen, and she's the same woman from Chuan Yu. They had, in fact, closed down one, changed their name, moved to another location sort of without telling me. I mean, I'm sure they told all the regular customers.
And so is she making the noodles?
She and her husband are. And it's a more elaborate restaurant than the other one, which I think was three or four tables and your elbow stuck to the table. You know, the kind of restaurant. And there's a little space and there are some, I don't want to call them non-noodle dishes, is actually broader than it was at the last one.
So when you order the dandan mian, is it a communal dish or does everybody get their own smaller bowl?
It depends who you're with.
That's pretty funny.
I think most people will get their own bowl of dandan mian. Most of the Chinese customers there ain't sharing. Because when you're doing it, you want it your exact way. I mean, you want it to be as hot as you want. You want the pepper to be the same.
Sichuan pepper has a very particular effect on the mouth. And in a dish like this, there's a huge quantity of it in the dish. Describe what it feels like.
It's a numbing thing. It's almost like somebody hit you in the mouth in a certain respect. There's a little bit of the dental chair to it, its numbing aspect. I mean, it has been explained to me, I don't know whether it's true or not, that one of the purposes of putting Sichuan pepper in is to numb the mouth enough that you can put even more of the other kinds of pepper in so that the capsaicin doesn't destroy you. Not that I or certainly any of your listeners would have anything to do with this, but there's sort of that like feeling of cocaine, but without the high involved in Sichuan pepper.
So, but aside from this mind-numbing aspect to the noodle dish, describe some of the flavors, some of the other flavors that come through.
I mean, there's some sweetness from the beans. There's a ton of umami from, you know, the beans and the pork and the peanuts and especially the yukai, the special pickled cabbage that's as much a part of any good Sichuan dish as the peppers are. And the noodles, I think, are fresh, though I wouldn't bet my life on it. But there's a life to them. There's a springiness to them. They're not the sort of dull, sort of clay-like noodles that you usually find in a preparation like this.
Is there anything else on the menu that you want to talk about besides the dandan noodles?
Yeah, there's some good stuff there. The one thing that I would suggest that you have to get, if they have it, is an occasional special of steamed pork belly over like a mound of what I think is toasted rice powder and pickled vegetables.
That sounds delicious.
It is so luscious. I mean, the steamed pork just falls apart.
What is the quality of the toasted rice powder that really engages people?
In some instances, like when in toasted rice, when you're talking about, say, you know, Thai cooking, it's crunchy. It's almost gritty. And when you're talking about in Vietnamese cooking, it has like a chewy quality. And the rice powder in Sichuan dishes is usually steamed to almost a firm porridge consistency. I mean, it's not quite bouncy, like, but it almost has like the bounciness of, say, polenta to it. It has a lot of the characteristics of polenta, except it's usually mixed with things, so it's super savory. It's not just the rice. They have a dish that's interesting of these giant fava beans that are sautéed with chili and garlic. They, like any Sichuan restaurant, they do hot pots with bits of fish or of frog or of beef or pork or chicken that are boiled in this giant broth. Actually, you don't eat the broth. It would kill you. It's basically the flavor of the food. Of chilies and more chilies and other chilies. The pickled chili, the dried chili, the fresh chili, and the Sichuan pepper is a combination that you see a lot. And it's not just pure hotness. It's like different fugal layers of hotness playing off of each other. there was a dish that I loved of cold or warm poached chicken with sort of chili oil on it that was delicious. And I think the best version I've had of twice cooked pork.
So what are the two ways it's cooked?
It's boiled or simmered until it's pork belly. Everything's pork belly. And then they saute it at the end with vegetables, maybe some like leeks and some garlic and some beans and other things that you want to eat.
Great. Thank you so much.
Glad to be here.
We've been talking about Lucky Noodle King on Valley Boulevard in San Gabriel. Get the exact address sent to your cell phone in a text message. Simply text the words good food to 69866. That's good food to 69866. And find all of Jonathan's restaurant recommendations on the Good Food Restaurant Map. It's on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. When Good Food returns, we'll get a lesson in growing tomatoes. It's Tomatoes 101, plus an interview with U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. That's next. Stay tuned. This is KCRW and KCRW.com. Welcome back to Good Food. I'm your host, Evan Kleiman. It's that time of year when you can start thinking about your summer garden and the bounty of tomatoes that's in your future. In fact, at farmers markets and nurseries around LA, there are little tomato seedlings ready to be planted. I always grow loads of tomatoes, but Good Food producer Harriet Ells hasn't been as lucky. So she sat down with Scott Daig, who runs the yearly tomato plant extravaganza called Tomato Mania, to get some help.
I grew up in New York City. No planting, no gardening in my childhood, nothing. So the last 2 years, I've tried to grow tomatoes and I've failed. Right. I'm going to do them in pots.
Good. That's fine. Lots of us do.
Now, what kind of pots and how big?
It's pretty simple. Number one, size of the container. You can't grow a reliable tomato or expect a crop in a 6-inch pot. 15 by 15 minimum. Anything that will hold soil and drain can be used as a container. But when we talk about a container, we want it to be big, and preferably we want it to not heat up. And what I mean by that is it should be maybe wood, or it might be pulp. It might be, you know, resin that's light-colored, for example. Anything that doesn't heat up, those are your goals. So large, it drains well, and it won't heat up.
And so what about terracotta?
Well, terracotta is going to heat up. This depends on your situation. Now, we talk about the heat because normally when we use containers, we're not putting them in the middle of the lawn. We're putting them on cement, stone, asphalt. All that reflected heat really, really affects a plant. So terracotta is going to do that even though it breathes. If you don't want to buy totally new pots, if you've got them sitting there on the patio, wrap your pots once you plant them. Take them out. Take the sun out of the equation.
Wrap them in what?
I always say old drapes, burlap, newspaper, whatever makes sense in your space. But yeah, just you basically create a situation that is more like a tomato in the ground. The roots are cool. That's the bottom line.
Okay, so I'm going to go to an event like yours, Tomato Mania, buy a little seedling.
Yes.
I put it in the big 15 by 15 pot.
Right.
And what kind of soil?
Well, that's what you have to start with, right? I'm a lazy gardener, so I don't do complex combinations in a pot. Lots of people do, and this is your advantage. What I would tell you to do is mix a planting mix or a potting soil with other composty rich materials, bagged or otherwise, from your own compost, worm castings, any number of things that, again, you're trying to recreate what's in the ground or the nutrient base that's in the ground. And hey, you have a great opportunity here to create the perfect soil. So again, start with a premium planting or potting mix, and then add rich things to it, amendments that you would put in the ground, worm castings, all that kind of stuff. That's what you begin with. So you fill the pot, right? You put that little seedling in there. And it's going to look very lonely, very lonely at the beginning. And that's okay. We all do that. We all go, wow, is that really going to? And yes, it's going to fill that pot. So plant it deep. Generally, we'll take off the bottom leaves and plant an inch or two of the stem, right? Create that great soil mix and then water it. And then key here in the first bit is that you don't have to soak that entire pot the first few weeks.
So now I've heard Evan has told me that you want to be pinching.
Well, here's the thing. As the tomato grows, you will have a main leader, that is your main stalk, if you will, of the tomato, and you'll get little growths that happen right at the point where the leaf meets the main stem. That's normally called a sucker. In truth, it's side branching. It's going to fruit. So you as the gardener get to decide, do I support that branch? Do I let it stay there? Do I have a big, bushier, you know, larger, maybe harder to handle sort of size plant, right? Or do I pinch it? You can take that off. If you take that off, and if you're coastal, for instance, you're getting more sun to the inside of the plant, more heat. You need that if you're growing near the beach, right? That's a good strategy. If you're in a hotter area, you don't pinch probably so much because you need cover for the growing tomatoes so they don't scald. So it's a question that we talk to in terms of size and ultimate, you know, staking and that of the tomato. But it's also a strategy. It can also be a strategy and help you or hurt you.
So what about feeding the tomatoes and fertilizing as well?
Okay. Water's the first thing we mess up. Feeding is the second. If you're growing in containers, you have less to worry about, but you have more to do. And what I mean by that is this. Tomatoes can easily be overfed. They're really randy weeds out there, and they don't need as much as sometimes we'd like to give them. So in a container, after you get your soil set up, right, you're going to mix a little fertilizer in there. You know, I like to use a well-balanced organic. That's mm-hmm. up to you. If you're doing that, follow the directions, and reading directions is important, and put that in and mix it into the soil as you plant your tomato. Now it's all set up. You're going to water. You're good to go. In a container, when you water today, you're flushing out yesterday's fertilizer because your drainage is so good, right? It's just going right out of the bottom of the pot. It's not staying in the soil for the plant to get it later, correct, or down below the root zone. So as a container grower, you need to be fertilizing in that pot, I like to say, every 10 days. You'll remember every 2 weeks, and that's cool. But somehow, some way, the plant needs to get food, whether it's a granular, whether it's a foliar feed, which is great, and you spray the leaves and soak the roots. That's beautiful. Somehow, some way, you got to fertilize. And the key to fertilizing is to use a balanced fertilizer. There are three numbers on a fertilizer bag. Those should be more balanced than disparate. That's the rule. And you will be giving the plant the three major nutrients it needs. And again, in a container, it's consistency that matters. It's very, very important that you do that.
So one of the things that happened to me last year is that I would water it, you know, I thought enough, but it still turned brown. The leaves were yes. dry.
Right.
And it basically looked dead.
Well, I hate to hear that. And hopefully we'll have you do better this year. And we haven't talked about what plants you're going to grow, which is part of that. But if you're on top of the water, which is your key element in a container, you hopefully won't see it turn dry and crispy overnight, right? Or on that long weekend while you're away. But what happens as the plant develops and as it goes through the life cycle of the plant is that it will yellow. That's almost inevitable. It's very hard for us as gardeners, and especially as a beginning gardener, it may freak you out and, you know, you think the thing is dying. The plant is going, I like to say it's on a steady trot to the compost pile, right? It's gorgeous and green in the beginning of the season. And as it grows, it begins to concentrate on fruit later in the season, not pretty leaves. So it begins to slough off, basically, leaves that it doesn't, especially at the bottom, right? It generally starts at the bottom. They don't need that anymore. So you as the gardener can remove that. But know that part of this journey is going to be you'll have a gorgeous plant in the beginning of the season. Toward the end, not so much in most cases. But the bonus is that as it follows that arc, fruit is produced and seed is produced. That's what the plant's doing. And we get to enjoy lovely tomatoes.
Follow Harriet's progress on the Good Food blog. She'll be buying her plants at the Encino Tomato Mania next weekend. Their full schedule is also on our blog.
On Wednesday, U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack was in the Southland to meet with Long Beach Mayor Bob Foster. In 2010, California ports handled more than $35 billion in agricultural exports. Products include meat, almonds, wine, cotton, and pistachios, among others. I guess my first question, big picture, would be how does California rank among U.S. states in agricultural production and trade?
No, obviously California is the number one state in terms of production, and more agricultural products come through California and through the ports in California than any other state. So it's obviously a very, very important state for American agriculture and for the American economy. The more trade we do, the more income for farmers and ranchers and growers, and the more jobs are created as a result of it.
How much trade does move through the Long Beach port?
You mentioned the $35 billion number, and I think roughly half of that goes through Long Beach. You have the ports in San Francisco and Los Angeles who also contribute. A very significant opportunity for us, and I think we're looking at actually expanding on that opportunity with the Korean Free Trade Agreement that's going to be presented to Congress.
Let's talk for a minute about that Korean Free Trade Agreement. What does it mean exactly in terms of the exchange? What will we be sending to them? How much? And what do we get in return?
We expect an increased trade with Korea of roughly $10 billion. And of that number, $1.9 billion is expected to be agricultural trade. For California, that involves dairy. It involves nuts. It involves beef produced here in this state. Basically, what happens is this agreement will reduce tariffs that Korea currently assesses on our goods anywhere from a couple percentage points to as high as 53% of tariffs, and that makes our products less competitive in the global market. By the execution of this agreement, those tariffs will be removed, many of them immediately, and some over a period of time. As they're removed, our products become more competitive on the market, and we expect and anticipate more American agricultural products to be purchased. And so we're looking forward to this because it obviously increases market opportunities for farmers, ranchers, and growers, but it also, we believe, will generate thousands of new jobs in the economy as well.
Particularly in terms of our trade exchange with food with China, people are concerned about the same level of standards of imports.
Well, they can be reassured that anything that comes into this country in terms of food has to come from a place that we have determined in advance to be equivalent or better than anything that's done in the United States in terms of food safety, processing, and production. There's an equivalency requirement, which is why in many, many cases we don't allow food to come into the United States from other countries because they don't have processing and production facilities that are, in fact, equivalent when it comes to food safety.
You know, California is in so much financial trouble. Is agriculture one of the bright spots?
Well, it's certainly a bright spot, not only in California, but across the country. We saw farmer income generally raise somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 to 35% last year. We anticipate another strong income year this year, perhaps a record amount of income for farmers in terms of cash receipts. As you increase trade, and we anticipate a record trade year, increasing trade by over $20 billion to $135.5 billion, as you do that, you obviously are increasing the bottom lines. Commodity prices are very, very good and very strong right now, so producers are doing well. That, in turn, allows them to feel a little bit freer about purchasing equipment, and especially with the new tax bill that basically provides folks the opportunity to write off their entire cost of new equipment this year as opposed to over a period of years so that they can save on federal taxes, there should be great impetus to buy those new pieces of equipment. That, in turn, should put people to work building those new pieces of equipment. So our hope is that as we've begun to see an improving economy generally in this country, it's because agriculture, in part, has helped to lead the way.
Do you have any idea how much of the agricultural exports that we can expect to be increased will be organic?
We have a relatively small organic part of our agriculture. It's roughly 4% of agriculture today in the United States. We are in the process of negotiating with the EU on an equivalency arrangement where essentially everyone's standards would be essentially the same that would free up opportunities. Most of our organic trade is with Canada and with the EU. We just recently completed an equivalency agreement with Canada, and we're continuing to work with one on the EU.
The USDA's mission is primarily rural, but so many city-based people now care about healthy food and agriculture and are seeking to become partners with rural producers. You're in Long Beach right now, which is a major urban area with not a lot of healthy food options. Do you think urban agriculture is worth the investment and time of the USDA?
Well, not only is it worth it, but we're actually involved and engaged in that. And we're also involved and engaged in what we refer to as the Healthy Financing Initiative, trying to make sure that we have full-scale grocery stores in areas that do not have them today and make it very difficult for people to access a wide variety of nutritious options. Part of that is working with the Treasury Department and their New Market Credit Program. HHS has a series of programs. We have a series of programs. And some of our resources are, in fact, being used to create the networks that encourage urban gardens, community support agricultural activities, which link local producers with consumers. We're working with school districts to try to make sure they understand what's being grown and raised in their local area and encouraging them to do a better job of contracting with those local producers. So there's a wide variety of things under the rubric of Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food, which is a program that we have at the USDA that sort of takes advantage of all of the programs that we have at USDA and tries to direct them so that people have a better connection. So there's a lot going on at USDA.
We've been watching these images of Japan's agricultural land be inundated with seawater. Is the USDA monitoring how we can give not just food assistance, but agricultural assistance to Japan?
Yeah, I'm sending a letter today to my counterpart in Japan, asking him to feel free to contact us for any kind of assistance that they may need as they begin the process after they sort of get over the shock of this enormity of this challenge for them, that they start to figure out how they're going to rebuild places that have been devastated, including agricultural land, that we are stand ready and prepared to help them and assist them in any way we can. We have a good relationship with Japan. They are one of our strongest allies and friends, and we want to maintain that strength and relationship, and the president's been very clear that we're to do everything we possibly can to help these folks get through what is just an enormously difficult circumstance for them.
Thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule to be with us. We really appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you.
I've been talking with U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, who was at the Port of Long Beach earlier this week. I didn't have time on today's show for the full interview, but you can hear the whole thing or read the transcript on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. As Secretary Vilsack said, California is the largest producer of agricultural products. Our climate allows us to grow a cornucopia of fruits and vegetables. Some might say that citrus is our claim to fame, but like with any abundant crop, there are pests. And our citrus is under attack. I'm joined now by Patrick Gomes. He's an entomologist and the national coordinator of the USDA's Citrus Health Response Program.
In government, we make acronyms out of everything, so we refer to it as the CHIRP program. So I indicated to somebody the other day that I've been chirping longer than people have been tweeting. But the CHIRP came out of our efforts to try and take a more holistic approach to dealing with exotic pest threats to citrus in particular. First of all, we had to try and limit the further spread of citrus canker out of Florida. And at the time the program began in 2006, also was aimed at trying to prevent further spread of Wang Long Bing, or what's known as citrus greening disease of citrus. Very serious disease, one which there's no cure. We're also looking for any new pest that might enter the country.
So let's put this a little bit in context. How important is the citrus crop financially?
It's incredibly important in terms of jobs as well as the economy. Just in Florida and California combined, they generate about between $12 to $13 billion a year in revenues. And that crosses over many different sectors of the economy. In Florida, the major thrust of production is production for juice purposes. And so juice and the processing of juice is a very large component of the industry in Florida. In California, it's just the opposite. Most of the fruit is produced for fresh fruit consumption.
Now, is it a real possibility that these famed orchards of Florida could be so diminished that the industry could be wiped out?
It's been a tremendous adverse impact on Florida citrus production. The acreage has diminished each year. There's also an increase in terms of the abandoned groves, where farmers get to a point where it's no longer manageable, and they simply walk away. The grove remains there, and it becomes a very significant source of inoculum and further spread of the disease.
It becomes like a breeding ground.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, is the greening caused by a pest?
Citrus greening is caused by a bacterium, and it's spread by an insect vector, similar to the way mosquitoes spread human diseases. There's a small insect. It's a Haemopterus insect. Essentially, it's an insect that has, instead of chewing mouth parts, it has like a soda straw, a beak that it inserts into the leaf surface, and it sucks the sap out of the plant. And along with that, it takes up the bacteria, and then it replicates and continues to essentially infect the insect. And then when the insect flies to a healthy plant, then it transmits the disease.
Are we starting to see greening in California?
No, we have not seen any evidence of greening in California. We've done a lot of sampling and testing. However, the Asian citrus psyllid, which is the insect vector responsible for transmitting citrus greening, has invaded Southern California. It was first found back in 2008 in San Diego and Imperial counties, and then it's made its way northward. So now pretty much most of Southern California has fallen into the area that's quarantined for the Asian citrus psyllid.
Now, if we have backyard citrus trees or front yard citrus trees, is there something that we should be looking for in terms of knowing if we have a diseased tree?
Yes. Citrus greening certainly is probably by far the most serious threat, especially to California, because they do not have the disease. So by simply going out and taking a look and taking stock of your backyard tree is an important task. We can't get around everybody's property. The urban areas are the areas where generally pests are introduced. So one way that the listeners can help us is to go out and take a look at your tree. And if you see something that looks like it's causing damage, then to report it. And for those folks that are there locally in California, if you see something that you believe might be a new pest problem, California Department of Food and Agriculture has a hotline at 800-591-1899.
Find out what to look for in your citrus trees and how to protect California citrus at kcrw.com/goodfood. I'll be back in 1 minute with a book that's changing the way we approach food and cooking. That's next here on Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman, host of Good Food. Several months ago, I pre-ordered a $625 cookbook called Modernist Cuisine. It's a 2,400-plus page investigation into the science of cuisine that veers toward art. It's the most in-depth exploration of traditional cooking techniques to date and the most complete explanation and visualization of modern culinary technique. Nathan P. Myhrvold is the man behind the huge project. Myhrvold was chief technology officer at Microsoft and as co-founder of Intellectual Ventures is a prolific inventor and holder of thousands of patents. We're really fortunate that his voracious interest in food and cooking led him to spend so much time and resources to produce such a work. Could you define the title of your book, Modernist Cuisine?
Well, there's a revolution going on in cooking. It started in some ways in the mid-80s, where people started realizing that science might inform new cooking. Also, you had chefs like Ferran Adria and later Heston Blumenthal and others that were experimenting with new kinds of techniques, explicitly trying to expand the realm of culinary stuff beyond the things that have been handed down through the ages or even things that were developed in the 70s in Nouvelle Cuisine. And so I call that movement modernist cuisine. And this book is a reflection of that movement, both in terms of taking some inspiration from science and explaining how cooking actually works, as well as explaining some of these modern techniques that chefs have developed.
What do you say to people who dismiss modernist cuisine, which parts of it in the past have been called molecular gastronomy, as frivolous?
Well, one of the interesting things is lots of new innovations in cooking were labeled that way at the time. Lots of innovations in art and architecture and other things were labeled that way. So one analogy we like to use is to the Impressionist painters who in the 1870s started showing their things in Paris and were laughed at, reviled. Now today, if you go to see paintings by Cézanne or Manet or a variety of the other folks that were part of that movement, they're among the best-loved art in the world. Now, just because they were dismissed doesn't mean that all arguments, everything that's dismissed has to be great. But I think there really is greatness in modernist cuisine. And I think that people who tend to try to dismiss it prematurely either don't understand really all of what's in it or haven't had it done right.
Let's talk for a minute about the nomenclature, the difference in the nomenclature in cooking techniques between the traditional and modernist.
I think the biggest high-level difference is that in traditional cooking, you tend to use one technique to try to achieve multiple goals. So if you want to roast a chicken, you put the chicken in the oven, and you have to decide what temperature you're setting the oven at and how long the chicken stays there. Some people say, oh, cook it at 450 at this amount. Other people say 325 for that amount. In modernist cooking, in general, you try to get more control over the cooking process. So the problem with roasting your chicken at 325 is you're not going to get a very crispy skin. The problem with roasting at a much higher temperature, you'll get a crispy skin, but you'll overcook some of the meat. These goals are fundamentally in opposition. So the way we cook our chicken is we roast it at a very low oven, only 145 degrees, for 4.5 hours. Then we take it out and we crank the oven up to 550 degrees and put it in for 6 minutes. Now, by separating into those two stages, we get way more control over the cooking process. The technique that we often use instead of braising is sous vide, where you cook it usually either in liquid or sealed into a plastic bag, although frankly the sealing is the least part of it. And then you cook it at low temperature for a long period of time. Now, long in traditional cooking might mean 6 hours. That's a short period of time for us. We have a recipe in the book where you cook for 100 hours. Now, that's pretty uncommon, but we have lots of things we'll cook for 24, 36, 48 hours. The reason we do new techniques is to achieve an effect we couldn't achieve any other way, or which we could achieve but not reliably or easily. So I'm making some ribs, some smoked ribs. Right now, we're talking in L.A. The ribs are cooking in Seattle, and I smoked them first in a smoker for 4 hours. And then I put them in to cook for 48 hours at 140 Fahrenheit. That kind of long, slow cooking gets you a texture of the meat that you just can't get any other way. It's tender, but not too tender. With ribs, one of the issues is you have a lot of connective tissue, membranes and stuff like that, and you have a lot of fat. And when people say that they want to cook fat to achieve a particular purpose, what they're really trying to do is take the collagen in the fat and cook it hard enough so that it becomes tender. It's the same thing you do in cooking a lean piece of meat that's very tough. Usually toughness is because of collagen.
Now, this project is the result of a whole team of people. There's no way one man could have done this all on his own. As your group went through the last 3 years doing all of the research for the book, was there a particular moment or discovery or technique that sort of blew your mind while you were right in the middle of it?
Oh, there were lots of them. I'll just mention a couple of them. A lot of people, particularly when they're cooking green vegetables, will plunge food into ice water to stop the cooking. It doesn't stop the cooking. It doesn't stop the cooking at all.
Really?
Yes.
What causes the color change in the vegetable?
It has to do with getting air out of little pores in the skin. And some heat-related things. But it's not about stopping the cooking in the sense that if I say, what's the maximum temperature that the food would reach? Suppose I took it out of the cooking water in this case and I put it on the counter versus I took it out of the cooking water and I plunged it into ice water. The maximum temperature that the food will achieve in the core is the same within a fraction of a degree.
So did you come up with the technique to actually stop the cooking process?
No. In that case, the only way to really stop the cooking process would be to inject cold into the center of the food faster than you can get by conduction. So, yeah, we thought about a way to do it. If you had a roast and you wanted to stop it cooking, what you do is you take a whole bunch of ice-cold aluminum nails and you stick them in very quickly. So it could be done. Now, we've not found a use or a reason to do that. So that's one example. But another example is you can use baking soda to make things brown better. So we make a French onion soup in like 30 minutes. You pressure cook it and you put a little bit of baking soda in. When we render fat, like render chicken fat or other sorts of fat, if you want it to taste roasted, you render it with a little baking soda in a pressure cooker. It gives this fantastic roasted flavor. And the reason is that the Maillard reactions, which are responsible for browning food and for making the roast flavors, they happen at lower temperature and faster in an alkaline environment. The baking soda biases things a little bit alkaline, and it makes a huge difference.
You are such a prolific inventor. In the process of working on this book, did your mind just come up with hundreds of more inventions?
I came up with a way to do what looks like fried eggs that are perfectly done for 100 people. The problem with cooking eggs is that the egg white and the egg yolk will coagulate at different temperatures. Basically, if you want to have a runny yolk, you don't want the yolk more than about 145 degrees Fahrenheit. Whereas the white, you'd like to get it – the texture I prefer in white is about 175 degrees. If you take it higher, it gets more rubbery. So when you cook eggs sunny side up, you have this very high heat at the bottom, and you're trying to get enough heat to come up to cook the yolk. And it's hard to get it done right. It's also hard to do it for a whole bunch of people simultaneously. So again, using a CVAP oven or a combi oven, we came up with this very simple technique. You put down silicon, baking trays and egg rings, and you just put the whites in. And then you steam it at 175 degrees, which makes all of your whites perfect texture. Then you take the trays out, and you put the yolks on the center, and you put it back in at 145 degrees. And now you can get the perfect texture of the yolk without having it be hard at the edges and so forth. And you get the perfect texture of the white. And because you can load it in one of these big ovens, you could do it for 100 people simultaneously.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
I've been talking with Nathan Myhrvold, whose latest work is the 6-volume Modernist Cuisine. I consider Nathan Myhrvold to be a revolutionary when it comes to food. I've got a list of other Che Guevaras in the kitchen at kcrw.com/5things. I'll be back after this short break with Gustavo Arellano and a trip to Orange County. We'll visit a chorizo factory, and we'll find out how corn tortillas are made. That's next.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Gustavo Arellano with Good Food. It's an early Saturday morning, and we're standing outside Ochoa's Chorizo here in Santa Ana. It's really chilly, but that means it's time for chorizo. Chorizo, of course, is a great Mexican sausage inside of a natural casing filled with chili, peppers, a little bit of cinnamon sometimes, made from pork, of course. Mexicans usually like to eat it in a torta, a Mexican sandwich, or a taco, or most famously in huevos rancheros, where you mix up the eggs and some chorizo, and you have a wonderful day ahead of you. We're starting to see Mexican families come into Ochoa's, which has been selling chorizo for 35 years in Santa Ana out of a house, and only recently have they started their own chorizo factory. So let's go and get some chorizo. So I'm here with Aurora and Salvador Ochoa. They're the founders of Ochoa's Chorizo. Buenos días.
Buenos días.
¿Cómo empezaron haciendo chorizo? How did you guys start making chorizo?
Empezamos haciendo de 10 libras hace 35 años.
They started making chorizo 35 years ago, started with 10 pounds, then 20, then 40. Now they're making 3,000 pounds a week. Roughly, she started making chorizo because she was a stay-at-home mom. She had nothing to do, but she wanted to make some money also. So she started making this chorizo first for the family, then people around the neighborhood here in Santa Ana where they had their house. They wanted some, and then more and more people wanted some. But eventually, they decided to open up a store, but she said she didn't want to do the store because she thought that her customers wouldn't follow her. And the daughter said, "Of course they're going to follow you. You guys make this great chorizo." ¿Cuál es el secreto de su chorizo? So I asked them, "What's the secret of the recipe?" And they said, "It's all about the ingredients. It's all about the care of the quality of products." You know, they were making it on their own from their house for almost 35 years. Companies wanted to buy the recipe from them, but they refused to do that. So now there's shipping off the chorizo to Chicago, to Colorado. Now, the whole family was involved, and they ground the meat by hand, all her children, and eventually they got tired of it, because you can imagine just grinding and grinding and grinding. She went down to Tijuana one time, found this meat grinder that, as she says, changed their lives forever, allowed them to make even more chorizo. So, muchas gracias por la entrevista. Now we're inside Ochoa's Chorizo Factory, and I'm speaking with Sal Jr., who's in charge of the factory itself. How's it going, Sal?
Pretty good.
Thank you. Talk to us then about the different chorizos that your family makes and how do you guys make them?
Well, we have four varieties, one being the green chorizo with a green natural chili. Then we have the chicken chorizo, which is spicy. That is done with a Japanese chili, dry Japanese chili. Then we have the mild version, which is done with California chili, which is a milder version of chili.
And where do you guys get your meats from?
We get it from a Vietnamese store in Westminster, California.
Your mom told us earlier that all of you children were involved in making the chorizo when you were young, that you would all have to hand crank that meat grinder. Can you give us some memories of as a little kid making chorizo?
Yeah, I remember back in the late 70s on Cedar Street, we would get out from school. My mom would be making the chorizo. So one of us, my brother Marco and myself, we would get there and it's your turn to crank the meat grinder. You would get tired and then somebody else will do it. But also, a hard version would be mixing the meat. You had to do it by hand. A lot of the times the meat would be frozen cold and it would be very, very hard. But, you know, we did it.
What do you think is the best way to prepare your chorizo for anybody who buys a chorizo?
Well, I love chorizo taquitos, and what basically do, I get it out of the casing and I fry it. You don't have to put nothing. Basically, fries itself. Then I do taquitos with cilantro, salsa. You can even do a chorizo hot dog.
Mmm, chorizo hot dog. I'm all over
chorizo
that.
Hot dog.
I love to eat my chorizo in a torta. You get two or three links in there, grill them properly so just a little bit of grease bubbles up, and you put some crema fresca, some cheese, you toast that bolillo itself, and then you just have this wonderful, wonderful sandwich. So if you want to try great chorizo, then come to Ochoa's Chorizo. It's at 220 West Warner Avenue in Santa Ana. For Good Food, I'm Gustavo Arellano.
While Gustavo shopped for chorizo, I was just down the street looking for tortillas.
We have chicharrones. We have all the different types of tamales. We have pork, beef, chicken. Then we have the ribs, the Mexican ribs with a sauce. So we have the head, the beef head. We have chickens. We have carnitas, which is pork. We sell more carnitas than anybody in the country. We're number one.
I'm talking with Rudy Navarrete. His family owns El Toro down here on Bristol in Santa Ana, and it's really totally amazing, lively place. We're here in the late afternoon on a weekday, and it's just packed with people. So is this the kind of place that started with one little area where you sold one thing, and then little by little you added?
There was this one shop like this from this pillar. Matter of fact, this is what it was, the pillar to that wall. That was the first meat market we had. And every year, my parents grew one more. Then that was the next pillar we got. And then the next pillar we got, that was the market. And then we had the tortilla factory, because we moved the market over there. This became the tortilla factory. Then we bought another house on the other side. And then the following year, we bought another house. And the following year, we bought a car lot. And eventually, we bought the last house towards the corner. Then we made the liquor store. And have Parky.
Let's go back and take a look at where the tortillas are made and talk some more about them. We're in the back room where they actually make the masa. They make the nixtamal.
That's right. We make this every day. Then we make like 40, 50,000 bags a day of tortillas.
In the process here, I see you have these huge troughs with corn in various stages. Over here, is this the beginning where you can still see the hard kernel of the corn on the outside?
It's already been cooked, and they put lime in. The only thing it has is lime and water.
And by lime, you don't mean the citrus fruit. You mean the powder.
Powder lime. It'll take the coating off the corn so we can grind it. That's the finished product over there after we washed it. After this stage, then we go to the grinder. They've been doing these limestone, you know, grinding for like the beginning of time. I mean, it doesn't change. There's no other way of doing it. And the corn that we have here is a white corn, which is the more expensive but the better tortilla. A lot of people use yellow corn, but tortilla gets to be a little bit hard. This one seems to be nice and soft.
So beautiful. Do you make any other products out of the fresh masa other than the tortillas?
Yeah, we make sopes, which is like a tostada. Then we make tamales, too, out of all this masa.
Thank you so much, Rudy. It's been so great.
See pictures of Santa Ana treasures, Ochoa Chorizo and El Toro at kcrw.com/goodfood. I'm really excited to announce that Gustavo Arellano will be joining me at the Broad Stage on May 1st for a lively discussion about global street food. Tickets go on sale March 23rd. More info is at kcrw.com/globalstreetfood. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast at kcrw.com/goodfood or through iTunes. And you can find great recipes, videos, and information throughout the week on the Good Food blog. It's all at kcrw.com/goodfood. Harriet Ells produced and edited today's show with help from our segment producers, Julian Ferguson, Candace Moyer, and Laurel Garcia. Ronnie Nicholson mixed today's show. Thanks to Gary Masiha, Becky Nelson, and Bob Carlson. I'm Evan Kleiman. I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.